Pam Morritt, you're the board chair for the Bush Foundation. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It is great to be here. I am enjoying my third visit to Rapid City and having the time of my life.
Fantastic. I know you visited Rapid City with the Bush Foundation board just recently.
Right.
You came back with some impressions. The board came back with some impressions of Rapid City that you had shared.
I think people were excited about making the trip. The Bush Foundation's geographic footprint is North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota, so we try to go out to various parts of that region. And so the board was looking forward to it, but I believe it's fair to say they came away with a more positive impression and a lot more excited about the vitality and innovation and really very exciting things that are happening in Rapid City. And we thought it was a great place, but I think we saw a whole new level of, I'll call it, innovation.
What were some of the examples of that?
A couple of them. I think some of the stuff that maybe everybody is aware of here, like the School of Mines, is one example. But I think there's some things that are going on that are less obvious. So, you know, East of Fifth is an area that is clearly on the verge of breaking out in entirely new ways. Main Street Square, the garage, the work that's happening in education on personalized learning, TIE, I believe it's called. We had a number of these kinds of things that came, in front of us. And there was just one after another, and people were really wowed by it. I personally was wowed by it. And I sometimes, as I talk to just sort of the average person on the street in Rapid City, I don't hear as many people lift that up. And so to me, it feels like there's a public relations opportunity for Rapid City to public relations itself and understand how much of that is really happening here and embrace that, because it is a sign of a vital, forward-looking place that I think has a lot more potential than is currently even being activated.
Oh, thank you. I want to switch topics just a little bit and ask about something you've spoken on, I know, in the past, social entrepreneurism.
Mm-hmm.
What is that for folks who don't know what social entrepreneurism is?
It's sort of a mushy space. People use different labels for it. But I think at its core, it's trying to take the best of a well-run business and marry it with social impact. And so it is typically a business that either through its goods that it's making or the services it's providing, or in some cases the profit that it is making, is trying to pour that back into a community good or solve a community problem. So as a result, there are a lot of different flavors. I happen to be working closely with a beer company, even though I'm not that big a beer fan, on in Minneapolis called Finnegan's Beer, which was an early mover in this space, and they take their profits and pour it over into hunger-related issues and food security in the Twin Cities. And so they are now actually building what is called a Brewtel, which is a brewery with a hotel on top of it, not far from the new Viking Stadium. And it's an example of a business that is a real business, and, you know, Jackie has to make money like everybody else and find distributors and brew good stuff and everything. But the whole purpose of doing it is to actually have an impact on a societal problem. And there are countless examples, but this is a little bit, it's a newer space than the very tried and true, you know, true for-profit or true nonprofit. But it is a very creative space with lots of interesting things going on, and millennials are very attracted to it. So for, you know, both communities and companies that are trying to make sure that they've got a pipeline of talent and new people coming into the business or the community with energy, it's a really exciting place to be with all kinds of future potential.
The system we live in, though, seems to value profit. I mean, it's all about the bottom line for shareholders,
right,
for most companies.
I agree.
How do you energize or create social entrepreneurism that really makes a difference within the system that we live in?
Yeah, and I don't think it's, you know, there's a no snap your fingers kind of formula. I think in some cases, the good news is that, 20 and 30 somethings are showing up with this community societal level of concern that might be different than previous generations, and yet they still want to earn a living and, you know, take care of their families and whatnot. And so the union of those two, that tension in between those two spaces, is bubbling up and creating some of this opportunity. And that's partly why I say it's a new creative space, because I don't think there's just like one or two ways to do this. There are lots of flavors, and there are people who are starting brand new things. There are people who are joining nonprofits but creating revenue generating opportunities inside nonprofits that create a social entrepreneurial opportunity. There are people who are starting new for-profits, but they're committing by their bylaws or charter to pour over some of the revenue or profits into other causes. So there are a lot of different flavors, and I think it is doesn't seem to need a whole lot of, you don't have to put too much water and fertilizer on this opportunity right now. What I think it does need is money and wisdom and showcasing examples to get more people to do it. I know that the Twin Cities, for example, has a lot of this spontaneously combusting. And what we want to do is create, you know, allow it to grow and be even more encouraged than it has been.
I want to ask, if I can, a bit of a philosophical, political question. There's a notion out there that those in our society who need help, or the safety net we need to create in this society for those on the bottom rung of the economic ladder, should be funded by charitable organizations and nonprofits. This should be the role. It should be voluntary. Then there's another group that says, no, taxes need to play a role in this, and government needs to play a role in this. Where's the boundary between these two? How much do we have to have government support, and how much it should be voluntary to run all of these things you're talking about in society?
You know, we have a fantastic country, but if you look at the level of challenge that we have, I think that the answer to that has to be, yes, we need both of those things. I don't think, I used an example earlier today on homelessness. I sincerely doubt that we're going to solve homelessness by simply one solution. It probably is going to have to be a combination of things where we think about affordable housing in different ways and have creativity around that with tiny houses and, you know, shared dwellings and things like that. I also think it will take a lot of generosity in order to try and help people conquer addictions and do things like that. I don't know that there's a real revenue model there per se. I think it'll take lots of creative solutions, because most of the most intractable problems in our communities and society, if they were simple, somebody would have solved them by now. And so it will probably take a multifaceted set of solutions. And I think it's one of the sort of magic aspects of a social business in my mind, is that it in effect harnesses the power of the sort of spirit and missional sense of a nonprofit, but the effectiveness and well-run aspect of a for-profit, and looks for ways to bring those things together in a new and different way. And it's the places where this is happening, and there are a lot of them, are really, really exciting.
And part of what the Bush Foundation does, part of what you does, are try to sort of use these sparks to start these fires, to make more of this
Absolutely.
Happen out there.
We'd like to see more, and just have people trying more examples, not all of which will succeed. Some of them will probably fail. That's also part of the process, is to winnow out the things that are powerful and the things that aren't. This is a really early stage thing for the Bush Foundation, so unlike some of our other programs that we've been doing literally for decades, this one is early, and you know, we have a lot of ideas now. It may look different in 3 years or 5 years, but I came from a social entrepreneurial business in my most recent job at Thrivent Financial, which is a not-for-profit financial services company, which is very uncommon, by the way. But it's a really powerful marriage of bringing together this strong not-for-profit mission, but still have to run a profitable, well-run business, or you go out of business. And it produced lots of innovation and lots of potential that otherwise might not be there.
I know you work a lot in Indian country and in tribal mm-hmm. lands around the states, the area the Bush Foundation covers. Do you see leadership there when it comes to social entrepreneurism?
Absolutely.
Can they show the rest of us a good way to go in any direction?
There are lots of examples there. I think an example that is happening now is there are a number of tribes that are coming together in South Dakota to create a wind energy project. Well, that's obviously a social business in trying to help us reduce our carbon footprint and dependence on oil and whatnot. It also is a very collaborative undertaking, which is really, I think, a first amongst these seven tribes. And they are really creating new governance models, new funding models, and new you know, and this is now getting legs and beginning to happen. It's really exciting. I don't know exactly where it'll be 5 years or 10 years from now, but it's an example of something that is certainly new for them, but it's also new for, you know, other parts of the, you know, South Dakota society, that you've got otherwise disparate groups coming together, and the sum of the parts, you know, is less than the whole all taken together. It's really cool.
Wow. I know the Bush Foundation, with some of that, is also working with tribal governments who may want to reorganize, or you're empowering
right.
that if tribal governments choose to work with you. Is how's that going?
It's exciting. I think these are, you know, it's taken 240 years for the United States of America to create the kind of, you know, just expected governance that we have today, with courts and police and, you know, contract law and all the things that we just take for granted as a means of having a very functional society. Unfortunately, many of the Native nations were handed kind of ill-conceived constitutions, you know, many, many years ago by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they're not very well done, and they're not culturally sensitive, and frankly, they're not even very well written. And so we're really trying to help a lot of the tribes, assuming they're interested in this, really take a step back and look at it. It's not fast work. It takes quite a long time, but it is very powerful in creating this much more solid foundation that culturally represents what's important to those people, and letting them build businesses and schools and communities and governance on top of it. It's really exciting work, and there's a new Native Governance Center that is beginning literally in the last few months that is now going to continue that work and take it to the next level.
All the things we've talked about so far, it sounds like you have a lot of optimism.
I do. I am an incurable optimist, and I'm not unrealistic. We have a lot of challenges, but I look back at the way in which we've solved problems, and you know, you solve one and a new one springs up. I think it's an old Hindu phrase. I might be getting the nationality wrong, but that says something like, everybody always has 88 problems, and you just hope that over time the quality of those problems keeps getting better. Meaning that they're often harder, meaning that they're often more intractable. But if you've solved the easy ones, then you start moving on to the hard ones. And I think we've got a lot of hard ones in front of us, and I'm still pretty optimistic that we'll solve them.
You've spoken as the role of a leader, that yeah. optimism is one of the important things that leaders...
I think realistic optimism is an important quality in a leader. Huh. You have to really, and you got to believe in the future, or sort of why bother? You know, the act of having a child is one of the most fundamental acts of optimism. But I just feel like when you have communities that, what's that old saying, that the old man who plants a seed today of an oak tree, an acorn, I guess that would be, is the sign of a healthy society, because it's a tree he'll never live to see, but he's optimistic about the future and wants to contribute to the future, and so he's planting the acorn today. And I think a lot of the things that we end up doing may not solve the problem, but it advances the conversation, it advances the solution set, and I may not be there to see all the solutions, but I am super optimistic about that possibility.
Pam Moore, thanks so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.